Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Not Just New Movies podcast, the show where we review a seemingly random film currently not in theaters. My name is Ben Pearson, and today we're going to be talking about both versions of The Italian Job, the 1969 version directed by Peter Collinson and the 2003 version directed by F. Gary Gray. Joining me today is my regular co-host, Tyler. How's it going, sir?
I think it's F. Gary Gray.
It is actually F. Gary Gray.
It's so nice they named him twice.
That rhymes. Are you doing all right?
Sure does. Yeah, man. You know, just kind of hanging around St. Patrick's Day.
Oh, yeah. How was your St. Patrick's Day? What'd you do?
Drinking some green beer, had some fried pickles, watched Florida on the big screen at a bar. So
you're referring to bad. The University of Florida basketball game, yes. Did you guys have any sort of St. Patrick's Day parties or anything like that, or was it just kind of general?
No, I came home from work, I went and drank, and then I came home to go to work the next day, so no parties.
I kind of did the same thing. Pat and I went out to this bar down the street a little bit, and we just had like one drink and left just to say that we could do something. But we actually ran into Jason Mewes from Kevin Smith movies, like Jay of Jay and Silent
Bob. Oh, nice.
Fame, yeah. So that was kind of interesting.
Smoking pot?
No, he was skateboarding down the street, actually.
Oh, still pretty stereotypical.
Right, yeah. I was like, man, aren't you like 45? Why are you skateboarding? But
I think his AARP health insurance covers that. So, go.
Probably. All right. Old. What's that?
He's old.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Pure comedy right there. Okay, so if you guys are just joining us for the very first time, we start every episode with a character name game, transition into our media consume section where we talk about what we've been watching, move into our review of the week, and finish up with listener voicemails and emails. You can always leave us a voicemail at 904-469-6566 or email us at notjustnewmovies@gmail.com. And you can find this and every other episode of this podcast at notjustnewmovies.com. So, Tyler, you have the character name game this week.
I do.
What do you got in store?
You ready for this?
I am.
The character's name this week in the character name game is Amanda Grayson.
Amanda Grayson. All right.
Amanda Grayson.
We'll return to this at the very end.
I think it might be pretty easy.
Okay.
Littering.
All right. Cool. Well, something that you and a friend of the show and frequent guest Joe Leninger have been big supporters of is a kind of a newer game called In My Netflix or Up My Queue or whatever you
that is correct,
you choose
yes.
to call it. So do you have
something? Yeah, created by Joe Leninger / Merv Griffin enthusiast. we kind of came up with this idea, and it really only works if you know the person on the podcast. As we saw last week, I don't think it's very effective when you're meeting someone for the first time and then you're like, hey, guess what's in my Netflix queue based on what you've known about me from the last, I don't know, 55 seconds.
Right.
So, but yeah, we know each other pretty well. So I think these games tend to be a little more difficult, a little more entertaining when
yes.
It's among friends,
right.
Or at least professional acquaintances.
Right. When we don't Such have a guest on.
I wouldn't consider us friends. I'd consider us professional acquaintances.
Wow, that is a low blow. But okay.
I'm just kidding. barely that.
All right, well, let's kick on that theme music and get this thing going.
And welcome to Up My Netflix, or In My Netflix, or Up Your Queue. I'm your host, Tyler. I'm going to be asking Ben, our guest today, a series of questions, mostly concerning what is in my Netflix queue. I'll give him two choices, and he will choose the one that is actually in my queue. If he gets it correct, he wins a non-espoused number of points. And if he gets it incorrect, he does not win that. A random set of points, and he will be publicly mocked.
Right.
How are we doing today, Ben?
I'm okay. I'm a little nervous about being publicly mocked, but let's go.
Yeah, I hear you've been using this to try to get on Jeopardy, but it hasn't really been working out for you just to know about what's in my instant queue.
Right, yeah. That doesn't seem to be a proper category.
It really
show.
Doesn't help you at all, does it?
No.
They ask for more of a cornucopia or a plethora of topics, not just my instant queue. But anyway, I digress. So let's get started. Round one. I'm going to ask you going to give you two things that may or may not be in my instant queue. And you have to guess the correct one. Are we ready?
For the love of God, let's go.
All right. We have either The Tudors, Season 1, or The Guild, Season 1 and 2.
I'm going to say The Guild, Season 1 and 2.
Oh, that is incorrect. I actually have The Tudors, Season 1, in my queue. The Guild was suggested to me based on my affiliation with The Tudors, but I have not added it to my queue yet.
Okay.
Okay, so you did not get the 13 initial points for round 1. Sorry to say, but you can come back in the latter rounds.
All right, let's do it, yeah.
All right, round 2. What is in my Netflix queue? RoboCop 3 or Arena?
Oh, man, I've never heard of Arena, so I'm going to have to go RoboCop 3.
Oh, just because you haven't heard of it doesn't mean it's not in my queue. It's actually Arena. That not looking good for you, Ben.
What is Arena?
Not looking good for you at all. I'm just the game show host. I just have the answers. I don't have descriptions here. Just kidding. I'll actually look it up for you right now. Arena. Intergalactic gladiators regularly face off in a ring in brutal championship bouts, but it's been 1,000 years since an Earthling has had a shot. Now marooned human Steve Armstrong wants to break the losing streak. Despotic ruler Roger blocks Armstrong from competing, but with martial arts master Quinn in his corner, Armstrong dares to enter the arena, and take on Roger's regime. Oh, it's not Roger, it's Rogor, but
okay.
I read it as Roger.
I was getting ready to say, I can't fathom people being frightened of a despotic leader named Roger. But
yeah, he runs an intergalactic gladiator organization. His name's Roger. And there's a picture of the human with, like, kind of the classic wrestling helmet on, and just some just toothy alien.
Man, I guess I'm gonna... I guess I've got a rules question for you for up my Netflix. Is it possible to request a description before guessing, like the spelling bee?
Ooh, interesting. I don't think so, because, like I said, we know each other so well, and I think you're gonna guess exactly what I'll have.
Incorrect today, but yeah. Okay. Right.
Well, just maybe the rule can be you can use one of, like, that could be like a lifeline for one of the questions.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Maybe if we do it like that.
All right. Well, we'll take that into account next time. But all right, let's go to the.
All right. Well, you missed out on the 57 points from round 2. So you're still sporting that big goose egg, Ben.
Mm-hmm.
But round 3 is worth 177.6 points.
Okay.
Okay, which, if you get it, we'll pass you on into the fourth final bonus round.
All right.
Okay? So, round 3, what is in my instant queue? The Children of Sanchez or The Missing Lady?
Crap, I've never heard of either one of those. Man, now you're making me go on Tidal alone. I feel like The Children of Sanchez is so ridiculous that it sounds like something that you would want to watch, so let's go with that one.
Incorrect again. The Children of Sanchez is just a random movie I found. The Missing Lady is actually a 1940s serial featuring The Shadow. So yeah, you should keep up on your Shadow serials, Ben.
See, this is where that plot description thing would have come in handy.
Yeah, would have. Do you want to take a chance at round 4?
Yeah, we got to.
All right, round 4. What's in my queue? The Beast of Yucca Flats or Ghost in a Shell 2.0?
Good lord. See, I don't know if you want to be admitting that almost any of these are actually in your queue, but...
Right.
True. Man, I feel like I'm going to get this wrong.
Let me tell you that the bonus round's worth 500,000 points.
Okay, excellent.
You get to take the suitcase home with some amount of money in it.
I'm probably going to miss this, too. The Beast of Yucca Flats.
Actually, that was in my instant queue, but it no longer is. Ghost in a Shell 2.0 is still in my instant queue.
Wow.
So, you are 0-4 today.
Wow.
And you miss out on the 500,000 points, which would have gotten you the suitcase full of German francs from World War One, which obviously, as we know, are worth little to nothing.
Right. Man, okay, mark the date, Saturday, March 19th, 2011, 0-4. That's the first time that's happened in this in the history of this podcast.
And I must correct, Germans actually have the Deutschmark, not the franc.
Ah, yes. I wasn't going to call you out on that, but nicely done regardless.
Nice, nice.
All right, well...
You get a fuller examination into my mind based on what's actually in my net.
Yeah, that's true, and that's a place I'm not really sure the listeners are ready to go, but...
but at least you and I are closer.
Right, yeah, now I know. Those shadow serials are going to haunt my dreams, but... All right, well, let's go ahead and move on into the media consumed section. This is a part of the show where we talk about what we've been watching on TV or movies recently or any sort of special events or concerts or anything like that that we've attended. Tyler, what have you been consuming this week?
Oh, yeah, let me flip my game show card over. Well, I've been watching some Hercules, The Legendary Journeys. You know I'm a big fan of that show. I've been watching that.
Mm-hmm.
Checked out the Fraudcast this week, where a friend of the show, Vince Mancini, kind of holds his podcast over at filmdrunk.com.
Mm-hmm.
Entertaining stuff. They kind of take pride in the fact that they don't really talk about movies anymore, although Vince does try very hard to get at least one review done. And most of it is talking about internet memes and general pop culture things going on.
I believe it's pronounced memes, but go ahead.
Yeah. Also watched the Marc Maron podcast. I think he recently appeared on Conan a couple weeks back.
Yes.
He has a pretty good podcast. It's actually funny. I had a picture of him. There's this black and white picture of him doing his podcast in his garage, and it kind of basically it kind of accentuates the feeling I get when we do our podcast, where we're just kind of discussing things regardless of how we look.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's in his garage and is just surrounded with like computer equipment. And he's got headphones on. He's just talking to somebody else who has headphones on, and they just sit there and talk back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty ridiculous, but. He has some pretty good content. A lot of his like freeballing, like where he just talks about stuff at the beginning of the show, it's pretty insightful. He's actually admitted that, you know, he just doesn't walk in and start, you know, jibba jabbing. He like walks around the yard and does stuff and thinks about what he's going to talk about on the podcast that day. So it's kind of a good, it's a good listen, especially if you're kind of like at work and you're listening to podcasts and. You know, I'm running out of podcasts to listen to. You know, that's a good one to pick up.
Mm-hmm. What's the actual name? Is it like the WTF cast?
It's the WTF podcast. Yeah.
Okay.
So I think you can. I think it's WTFpod.com.
Okay.
So you just go over there, and he'll give you options on whether you can get it from iTunes, or if you don't have iTunes, you can get it from straight from the site. So he's pretty good about getting the podcast out.
Cool.
Possible guest, if we can get a hold of him.
Yeah, right.
Panther and I reviewed Chloe at notjustnewmovies.com this week, so we did like a audio review like you're prone to do, Ben.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then, Ben, you did Green Street Hooligans this week?
Yeah, that's actually the only thing that I was going to be talking about in my media consumed
section. Yeah, that's fine. Okay, we'll get to that. and then I wanted to kind of tell you about this movie I found on Netflix. Have you ever heard of Fred?
You would barely mentioned this person or entity to me right before we started.
Yeah, I barely
recording.
Know who he is. Like, I think I've come across his video on YouTube once, and I was completely turned off to his eccentricities. They're not funny, they're not entertaining, they're not even worth, like, watching once.
Mm-hmm.
You're stopped immediately by the horrific sounds that you hear and the images that you observe. But apparently this guy's got a movie, I guess... Somebody somewhere wanted to make money off of this horrendous train wreck of internet.
So, I mean, the person's name is Fred. Is it a child or?
I don't think so. I think he's a grown ass man, but he looks like a child. He's got like the long surfer hair that everybody's sporting nowadays. He's pretty generic looking.
So he's probably in his 20s then, right?
Maybe.
Okay, I don't know. I'm just saying, like, you're just saying, like, for people who have no idea what you're talking about, you're just saying a guy named Fred. Like, this could be a man of any age.
I really don't want anybody to know about him. I just want everybody to hate him. I take that back. I don't want everybody to know about him. I just want everybody to know how bad he's seen by the general public.
I see.
And so I came across the member reviews on Netflix, which are pretty humorous. Usually, even the worst movies I've seen on Netflix at least had somebody say, this is pretty bad, but I watched it, and it's still awful. But these people actually, like, stopped 5 minutes in, and they were like, I can't handle this. So I want to read a couple of the reviews just to kind of get you an idea of how terrible this people think this movie is.
Okay.
I haven't seen it. I'm not going to watch 5 minutes of it to kind of get my own. No, I'm going to use other people's opinion to back up my argument.
Right.
One star from, I'm not even going to read their names. Fred is one of the most annoying characters ever created. It is the exact opposite of funny. Avoid at all costs. And if your children enjoy this, then I think it is time for you to start putting them on the short bus. And for some reason, this has a spoiler alert tag on it. Next entry, one star. Is this supposed to be funny, in all caps? !! The guy throws tantrums all over the movie, and this is supposed to be funny? The guy needs to be thrown into a mental institute. Spoiler alert for some reason. Next entry, one star.
I don't think these people understand the meaning of spoiler alert. But
no, they don't. They don't. I think they're just saying this spoils your life. Next entry, one star. I saw 10 minutes of this movie and I had to leave the room. I would gouge my own eyes out rather than see any more of it. Okay, pretty standard response to a 10-minute movie. Next entry, one star. Doesn't even deserve a rating. That's how much it sucked, all in caps. Anyway, I think there should have been... There should have been any reason for funding this movie. There is no real reason to it, and it's just plain poorly done. Okay, the review needs a little grammatical adjustment, but still you get the idea.
Right.
Next entry, one star, most annoying movie ever. I takes either a seriously limited intellect or unlimited willpower to be able to suffer through this movie. Okay, and then the final entry, one star. The only thing I hate more than this movie are the people who give it a 5-star rating. I would give this movie no stars if I could. There is no integrity in a single aspect in the production of this garbage. I am hoping that even though the movie poster insinuates there will be more than one Fred movie, there won't. I would honestly watch any other movie than this one. Kids, please stop giving this moron money. And there's 118 pages of comments.
Wow. Well, that last one seemed a little bit more well-reasoned.
It was a little... Yeah, he was basically just kind of warning against us.
Yeah, it was almost pleading.
Start with page two, Ben?
What's that?
You want me to go on to page two?
No, please, no. I think everybody gets the idea. So avoid the movie. Is it just called Fred, or is it called Fred the Movie?
Fred the Movie.
Okay, well...
It's 82 minutes long.
All right, it's not good. I will never be watching that. So.
It's just funny. I think that should be like a new little game. Like read the comments of a terrible movie that no one's heard of on Netflix.
Or maybe we could do it where it's like read the comments of a movie and try to guess what that movie is or something. That would be
interesting. That one too.
Yeah. All right. We'll talk about this.
Either that one or the other, because the latter would be hard for a movie that no one's heard of before.
Yeah.
Guessing all day. But yeah, I like your idea.
All right. Anything else you've been consuming?
No, that's my consumption.
Okay, cool. Like I said, the only thing that I really got a chance to check out this week was Green Street Hooligans. If you guys haven't seen this movie, I highly recommend it. I wrote a review of it at notjustnewmovies.com, so you can find it there. And I'll just kind of briefly go through just a little bit in case you guys haven't heard of it. But it's directed by Lexi Alexander. It was her like feature debut. And it stars Elijah Wood and the guy named Charlie Hunnam, I think, or Hunnam. I'm not really sure how to pronounce his name. He's British or English. And basically it's kind of a typical story where a journalist goes overseas and kind of gets involved in a culture and kind of becomes you know, entrenched in this and, like, essentially becomes one of these people. It's like, you know, it's kind of like Point Break or whatever, like the Fast and the Furious or something, you know. Somebody goes to kind of infiltrate something and then becomes a part of that culture, basically. And this one, it's not necessarily just like that. Elijah Wood's character is kicked out of Harvard in the first, whatever, 10 minutes of the film, and then goes across to England to kind of meet up with his family and just kind of think things out and stuff. And he becomes involved in these, the culture of what they're called football firms, which is soccer hooligans, basically these groups of almost gangs that just kind of rally around their teams that they support. And they're not even so much concerned with the game, really, as much as they are with embarrassing the firms of the other teams and, you know, just kind of standing your ground and fighting and you know, just it's all about pride and kind of localization and chaos. You know, building up your own team and all this kind of loyalty and friendship and all this kind of stuff. So
was it Manchester United in the film?
No, it's not. It's what is the name of their team? It's
United.
It's totally. It is something United. It's Wyndham United, maybe, or I don't know. It's been now like, I don't know, 6 days or something.
I've always been an Arsenal fan. From
okay, yeah,
Nick Hornby book.
I don't think this is actually like in the upper tier of professional soccer or professional football. I think it's like one. I think it's almost like the equivalent of like the rookie league or something like that. You know, but regardless, I'm not doing a very good job of making this sound interesting. But the film is really awesome. It's really,
soccer's pretty sweet.
I mean,
slash football.
I'm not like a big fan of that sport, but this movie, I mean, it has just enough in there to kind of appease the soccer fans, but it also concentrates way more on just the relationships between Elijah Wood and Charlie Hunnam, who plays like the leader of this firm called the Green Street Elite. And there, that's, you know, the group that Elijah Wood's character kind of gets sucked into. And
are they hooligans?
Yeah, basically. They, you know, they're not like as barbaric as a gang, but they really are kind of, you know, all about, like they ride into other people's territory and just like fight them and brawl with way less people just to like have the word spread that they're badass enough to do it and stuff like that. You know, there's just a lot of, it's all about like legendary, you know, moves and stuff between gangs and everything. But I thought Elijah Wood was really excellent in the film. You know, the movie came out in 2005, so it's right after Lord of the Rings, and he definitely, you know, steps far away from the Frodo role to be in this. And then Charlie Hunnam, who I've never really heard of before this movie, he's in that TV show Sons of Anarchy, if you guys know that one. He was amazing in this movie. Like that, it's, I think he's been in some small things before this film, but it's kind of a hell of an introduction to this guy as an actor. He was actually in a movie called The Ledge that I saw at Sundance this year, so I wrote a review of that. You can find that at notjustnewmovies.com also. But anyway, I would highly recommend Green Street Hooligans. It's really, really a good film, and it's just a good story. It has all these really classical themes of betrayal and trust and friendship and all these things, but it's set in a world that we don't really see very often on film. I mean, soccer, it's a pretty popular sport, but it's very rarely depicted well on screen, I think. And this is one of those
big green
kind of this is one of those exceptions to the rule. So definitely check this
bend
movie
it
out.
Like Beckham.
Yeah, I've never seen.
I already it. Named two right there.
But I said well, and I've never seen any one of those, so I can't really say whether or not they do it well.
I thought you meant your vision of quality was mine for quantity.
Ah, I see. Actually, I don't understand what you mean at all, but
I took your idea of quality of film and took it as quantity of films about.
Yeah.
So I started naming films off.
The classic misunderstanding. Yeah.
Yeah. The your review of Green Street Hooligans is pretty good. So check it out on the .com.
Have you seen it?
Yeah, I watched it with you, I think, the first time you saw it.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, it's been, like I said, it's been like 6 years or something, so I never remember who's with me when I watched the original movie.
Yeah, I think we watched it at your house or somebody's house.
Yeah. Cool.
You guys are making fun of us soccer players because, I don't know, you guys can't play.
Right. Yeah, that's basically it. It was just pure jealousy. In any case, let's go ahead and move on into our review of The Italian Jobs.
What is The Italian Job?
A seating chaos, a smash and grab raid, and $4 million.
$4 million? I think we could take that over, Roger. Go! You're only supposed to blow the bloody doors off!
Good evening, Roger.
Croker.
Michael Caine does The Italian Job on the outside. Masterminding the job from the inside, Noel Coward. Two gentlemen on the job.
All right, so how do you want to do this, Tyler? Do you want to talk about the 1969 version first, or do you just want to do like one big discussion about all of them kind of intermingling?
I thought they were the same movie. I thought it was like a four-hour epic like Lawrence of Arabia.
You're insane. I hope you're joking.
But I guess it's wrong. Yeah, we can talk about the old one first, or okay. The Italian Job Senior.
Okay, so this film came out in 1969. It was directed by a guy named Peter Collinson. What did you think about this movie? Was it your first time watching this elderly version?
Yes, it was. I like Michael Caine. It was really, really pro-Britain, pro-British, especially with the soundtrack and just the, and of course, like the choir at the end, the mm-hmm. Self-Preservation Society.
Yep.
But it felt a lot like. And maybe this is just British films in the 60s, but it felt a little bit like a James Bond movie almost because, you know, the cars going around on the swerving roads kind mm-hmm. of made me feel, made it look like, I don't know, let's see, you know, one of the ones in the 60s, possibly Honor Majesty's Secret Service because that one had a lot of car chases in it. So as far as like the car chases, I thought it was a pretty cool movie.
Yeah. I definitely dug the car chases. This movie, you know, I'm very, very familiar with the 2003 version of The Italian Job. You know, I own it. I've seen it a bunch of times. But this was the first time I'd seen this one, and I was really interested to see how close of a representation the 2003 version was. And it's really, strangely, not that close. This movie feels like much more of a build-up and we'll talk about this when we get to the 03 one, but that one feels almost like a sequel. But anyway, this one, like it opens with Michael Caine's character kind of getting out of prison, and it's all this build up to the Italian job, you know, like this one thing. And he goes back and like recruits all these people and gets involved with Mr. Bridger, who is this kind of crooked warden, I guess, at the jail, right? That's what his job was.
Yeah, he's pro Britain. He's very British. What I'm trying to say is he's very nationalist. He loves his country. He loves the British government. He loves you know, the people from Britain. So I think why he kind of gets involved in this, spoiler alert.
Yeah.
Why he gets involved with the thieves is because he wants to bring that money back to Britain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he's got like this room that's like a shrine to the Queen and stuff.
Yeah.
And yeah, like you were saying, the movie itself is very much kind of plays up on that aspect because Quincy Jones did the score and they played, you know, the Queen's theme, that dun 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 dun. They played that, like, they overplayed that in this mm-hmm. score, I think. Mm-hmm. It was constant, almost.
A popular American song as well, which I kind of thought was weird. Come back to me, I'll think of it.
Okay. Yeah, like, I don't know, aside from that theme being kind of driven into our heads over and over and over again, I thought the score was actually kind of cool. You know, had this real kind of jazzy bass and clunky piano stuff going on. It was, I guess, representative of the time. The movie, you know, because it was shot, I guess, in 1969, it had a lot more kind of sex and sexual themes and stuff involved in it than I was expecting. I wasn't really thinking about it going in, like, kind of contextually with when the movie was made, but it's like right in the middle of the sexual revolution, basically. And it's like, you know, Charlie Croker, who is Michael Caine's character, is a lot more of kind of a scoundrel in this movie than he is in the 03 version, because he's like constantly trying to sleep with women and stuff, and like he gets out of prison and there's like whatever, his girlfriend has like 9 women lined up for him as like a
coming
out.
What's the big deal, baby? There were just a couple of birds here on my flat.
Yeah, and I think Austin Powers actually does take almost as much from like that kind of this kind of movie as it does the James Bond ones, you know, just like that era and that style.
Yeah,
and a lot of the cars
in like Flint movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the cars and stuff in Austin Powers seem more reminiscent of the cars in The Italian Job than they do in any of the Bond films. But and he's almost got like that kind of I'm talking about Mike Myers, almost has that kind of overpronounced like Michael Caine impression almost to some degree. But
well, then in Goldmember, his dad is Michael Caine, so it all kind of comes together.
Right, exactly, yes. Perfect perfect circle there.
What's going on off the Powers tangent?
Yeah, I know. but, like, even the Professor Peach, who was played by Benny Hill, strangely enough.
Professor Plum, I think, is what they said.
No, I don't think so. I think his name is Professor Peach.
Because I think, doesn't he call the wife? He goes, Mrs. Peach, and she goes, Plum. Or maybe I have it mixed up. Maybe he calls her Mrs. Plum and she goes, "It's Peach."
Yeah, I think that's
one of the two. That's one of the jokes of the movie.
Yeah, yeah. Clearly, Clue had
he loves the fatties.
Right. Yeah. That's. I mean, it's so weird. Like that. That's a plot point in this movie. You know, it's like he. Yeah, his name is Professor Simon Peach, by the way. But yeah, it's like that's a plot point. Like that seems like that's how Michael Caine. That's what he uses as leverage to get Peach involved with this whole thing. I just found that to be kind of a strange thing. But I guess for the time, you know, with a lot of those you know, awakenings and things going on, and people being very like open and stuff about all that, it wasn't that.
The guy's character.
Well, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. It definitely did, and that's actually leads me to the next thing, which. I don't think the secondary players in this movie were very well defined. I don't know. What did you think about that?
Yeah, I agree with you. Especially when you're comparing the two, which I guess we will eventually. But the characters in the first one, like there was Arthur, which he tended to talk. And then, of course, the professor and Michael Caine's character were pretty well, you know, you knew who they were.
Mm-hmm.
Arthur, I couldn't pick out of a lineup of the other characters. But yeah, like you were saying, that the other people on the job, you know, were just kind of random British guys with long hair that just kind of tagged along. And he, the scene where Michael Caine just kind of goes around the table and introduces everybody to the group, you're like, oh, this is probably going to be the only chance that the audience gets. And it was the only chance the audience got to kind of see everybody and get their name, because you really don't see any other character development as far as the rest of the group for the rest of the movie.
Mm-hmm. And the group is way larger, it seems, than in the later one. And that's probably to the film's detriment, I think, is because like there's no way. I don't know. I'm sure it was totally different. You know, for people back then, they were probably a little bit more familiar with those actors, clearly, than we are. I don't know if I've ever seen any of those other guys in any movie before. So it's like, I don't know those actors. It's not as easily recognizable as like, oh, that's Seth Green or something like that. You know what I mean? But
That was probably the Ocean's 11 of the British 60s.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I totally think that that's.
We don't know. We're not British.
But I think that has a lot to do
with Sean Connery in this, I don't know.
Well, you know, it's got that same kind of heist vibe and everything, and like the group and each person, you know, responsible is like a specialist with their own thing. You know, you got like the computer expert, which I thought was pretty funny in this version, because the Michael Caine gets this instructional video from what was the guy's name, like Breckenridge or something, like what was it?
I think his name was Roger, because he was talking to the tape.
Yeah, yeah, he was Yeah, so he gets this instructional video, and the guy's like going through all the plans and stuff with him, and he says like you have to sub this program into the computer system or whatever to kind of reroute all the traffic and stuff. And the program is actually like this huge roll, this double roll of film, basically. And I'm like, what the hell is that thing? Like, is that really how stuff used to be? Like, that was just kind of a funny, you know, thing for
and
us
then
to be.
He sleeps with the dead guy's wife.
Yeah, yeah. And he's like, oh.
Speaking of the sexual revolution.
Yeah, he's like,
it's all up for grabs, baby.
You still in your widow's gown or something like that. And she's like, yeah, there was no messing around there. But
That was a foreplay talk back in the day.
That's
your widow's gown.
That's disturbing. So. I don't know. Were there anything in particular that you wanted to bring up about this movie? Like, how did you think the action was executed, I guess, throughout or maybe leading up to, and then, like, the final kind of chase scene that comprises, like, the last 25 minutes of the movie?
I kept laughing because these guys, they drive their cars anywhere they want.
Mm-hmm.
Either we're inside buildings, inside malls, inside castles, it seemed like. And, like, who... Nobody locks their door. There aren't any locks on these doors that you can just drive hordes of cars in and just drive around inside buildings and stuff to try to get away. So that part was kind of comical, but that all adds to the kind of the heist film feel when they're driving through all the narrow passageways of the building and people dodging out of the way.
Right.
You know, obviously no one got hit in the movie, but in real life, that probably wouldn't pan out so well. The kind of the traffic jam idea was pretty cool. Although it was fun to watch that last part of the film because, you know, they kept having cops follow them, and you know they kept trying to find ways and try to evade the cops, and meanwhile, there's all this traffic going on, people trying to get through. So it was just kind of fun to watch. But, you know, it's spliced weird between them doing something and then they'll go back to Bridger's character.
Mm-hmm.
Is that his
name? Yeah, Mr. Bridger.
They'll play more British music and you're just kind of like, okay, let's go back to the car chase.
Yeah. There's stuff
going on, movie.
They've got, like, the prepping for the job montage of, like, them, you know, trying to ramp up the side with these cars.
Yeah.
And, like, all the guys who are just kind of lovable buffoons, basically, who work for Charlie Croker, who are just like, oh, sorry, Charlie. Like, you know, like, they just destroy.
Yes, Charlie.
And he has
to... burn that map. Okay, Charlie.
Yeah, I think
take care of this stuff, too. Okay, Charlie.
Yeah, I think the character of Arthur says yes, Charlie for 7 sentences in a row at one point.
Charlie.
There's like, you know, like the explosion scene when they rig the car up, and he's like, "You're supposed to blow the bloody doors off," or whatever. I thought that was really, really funny. And I read right after I saw the movie that line was voted the favorite movie one-liner in like a 2003 poll of like whatever of like British film fans or something like that. So I thought that was kind of
other than the ending, this movie was fun to watch. I mean, there weren't any. I mean, a lot of to the build up to the montage and the actual heist was a lot of just kind of jibba jabba.
Mm-hmm.
You know, talking about the heist, them. You know, getting people to be included in the heist, but it didn't for a moment was I kind of like, it's dragging on, you know, it felt like it was pacing well.
Yeah.
And then you get the montage and you get involved with the heist. And then the ending kind of says, I was so involved. The ending didn't really do it for me.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to that in just a second. One other thing that we should mention is like the mafia, I think like the inclusion of the mafia also does a good job at like, kind of keeping that pacing going that you're talking about where it's like, it's not, you know, like you become familiarized with the scheme in the beginning and then the mafia stuff is kind of mixed in and cross-cut with the weird, like Britannica themed stuff with the Queen's, shrine and all that, because they've got like, they do a good job of, even though there's not a lot of action throughout the first three quarters of the film, they take a couple of those cars and just throw them off the cliff in that one scene, you know, like the mafia guy kind of hijacks them as they're preparing for the heist and like uses that bulldozer thing to just knock it over.
See what happens to your car right here. Oh, you're losing his insurance bonus.
Yeah, and even those, like, you could tell that was actually really done. Like, they really threw those cars off that cliff, you know? Like, today, I'm sure they would use CG and stuff to kind of try to trick us into thinking it. But back then, they didn't have, like, that kind of technology, really, or at least being able to execute it to, like, a believable level. So it's actually kind of cool to see like practical effects and stuff like that being done and really get that feeling like, oh, okay, this actually means something as opposed to just like digital ones and zeros blowing up, you know?
True.
Well, let's talk about the ending. You wanted to mention that. What did you think about the actual like post heist? What did you think about the ending of the film?
Yeah. Well, you kind of know my interpretation of it. I don't like endings like that. I don't like endings that, you know, I'm the kind of person that wants everything tied up at the end of the movie, and this movie doesn't achieve that. You know, you don't know exactly what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why they did that, why that was their intention. I just don't understand.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's more of like a clever screenwriting thing than it is an actual well-executed ending. Like, it seems like a good idea on paper to have it end that way, but then it really does feel abrupt and just kind of like almost like it cheats you out a little bit of like
lazy.
Yeah, like we spent all this time with these people and watched them do this, and we're not even really sure like what really happens. I mean, I didn't have as much of a problem with it as you did, but I can definitely see why people would be disappointed with it.
But the whole movie, it's not like it was a farce. The whole movie, it wasn't like it was a parody of the heist film.
Uh-huh.
You know, that kind of ending would have fit. Okay, can we just reveal the ending? Spoiler.
Sure. Right? Yeah.
The bus that they're driving the gold on, it for some reason, Big William or whatever the driver's name is,
mm-hmm.
he teeters off the road, and half of the bus is like teetering off a cliff.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and the weight of the passengers and the gold on the bus is like moving the bus, whether it's going to stay on land or it's going to fall off the cliff.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're, you know, Charlie's character, or Charlie the character, he's like, everybody move to this side of the bus. So then the bus kind of moves back to a horizontal position.
Mm.
So, but the gold is still over on the other side of the bus, and he's trying to move the gold back to the side of the bus where they can get back onto the road. But as he's reaching for it, his weight causes the bus to tilt a little more down the cliff,
mm-hmm.
so the gold moves farther to the end of the bus.
Yeah.
And at this point, you're watching the movie, and you're like, okay, this is just kind of a barrier that they're going to have to kind of overcome to get back onto the road.
Yeah.
But then the movie ends.
Yeah.
Just ends with them teetering on the edge of a cliff with the gold at one end and everybody else on the other end.
Yeah.
It's not even, like, okay, here are a couple endings that could have worked. One, okay, obviously, they get the gold to the other side, they drive off, and they make it back.
Yeah.
Two, everybody gets off the bus, and the bus hurtles down into the ravine with all the gold blowing up, and they have to get away before the cops come.
Mm-hmm.
Three, the cops come while they're still teetering on the cliff, and they all get arrested or something happens. You just don't end the movie without anything happening.
Yeah. I think they
just want to go back in time and beat someone up.
I think they just ended it because the final line of like Charlie Croker's last line in the film is, "Hang on a minute, lads, I've got a great idea." And it's like that.
Right.
I think it's more of a character moment than a plot moment. And it's like, is a character moment as at the final, you know, in the final 10 seconds of the movie, really what you want to do, or don't you want to wrap this thing up? But they clearly, I mean, I don't know if that's a little bit more representative of how movies were back, you know, back in the time, or and, you know, us just kind of being used to more of our modern movie scene and kind of having everything presented to us a little bit more completely, or I wonder how, like, audiences back then would have reacted to this, if they would have been as split down the middle, or if people would have just been like, oh, okay, yeah, that was a great movie, like, you know, don't even really think twice about it because they didn't want to know. But I'm wondering if that's
British would want. I would think the British would want completion. That's like ending a James Bond movie. He's like, he's face to face with Blofeld, Mexican standoff.
Yeah.
Connery and Pleasance, or, you know, they're just pointing guns at each other, and then the movie ends.
Yeah.
Everybody wants an ending. They want to see who comes out on top.
Yeah. Yeah. I think...
if there was some fan fiction that completed the story, I'd be fine with that. But it's very hard to find fan fiction about a 1960s British film.
Yeah, as we've been talking about this, I think you've converted me over onto your side of this argument. Because I didn't really have that much of a problem with it. Because I was like, oh, kind of cool, like a literal cliffhanger ending. Like, you know, it's a like, character moment and whatever, and it's just kind of serves to show how Charlie's always scheming and he is always got the next big idea, you know, up his sleeve or whatever. But yeah, I think the movie, I don't know, I guess it's an interesting ending, whereas if they had gotten away with it, it would have just been more of an expected ending, you know? So maybe that's the...
Yeah, because you feel like they've gotten away with it for the last 10 minutes of the movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's why it needs an ending.
Yeah. All right.
We should write that ending.
And then go back and shoot it and then edit ourselves as
shoot
the
it
actors.
Using 1960s film technology. I've always wanted to do that. I've always wanted to make a movie using the technology of the decade that you're making the movie for. Like the Castlevania film that I say is never going to be made because it was supposed to be made, you know, 30 years ago.
Right.
So just take cameras and, you know, the cameras and the technology of the 1980s and apply it to today's actors. And I don't know. It'd be kind of a cool experiment. I think the movie would be popular for that fact alone.
Yeah. It would definitely be a gimmick, and it would get a lot of publicity. So
gimmick? It's an artistic choice, Ben.
Okay. Fair enough. I'm not going to debate you on that because I think you're actually right, but I don't know how reasonable it is to assume.
That's
that
twice today you've told me I'm right. I'm riding high, brother.
Yeah, you better ride high while you're up there.
While I can,
pretty quick.
I'm flying too close to the sun.
All right, Icarus, let's move on into our discussion of the 2003 version of this film. This one is directed by a guy named F. Gary Gray, as we said earlier.
F. Gary Gary.
What did you think about this movie? What's your history with this? Have you seen it a bunch of times, too?
Are we going to play the trailer for this?
Yeah, you know what? Let's play the trailer right now.
Come by, we'll have some breakfast.
It'll be a long trip. I'm in Venice.
Learn the language of poetry, art, romance, sex.
Unlike you, my friend, I don't need a guidebook.
The plan was flawless.
The next 45 minutes, we own this place, gentlemen.
Okay, Steve, it's right above you.
The heist was perfect. The escape was clean.
What are you going to do with your share?
I'm going to get a NAD T77 with the 70-watt amps and Burr Brown VACs. It's a big stereo. Speakers so loud they blow women's clothes off.
The only threat was the one they never saw coming.
What the hell are you doing?
I made a few plans of my own.
There's nowhere you can go or we won't find you.
That's probably right, John.
This summer.
Barnum's Teller. He's in Los Angeles.
Stealing that gold is not going to bring my father back.
It's not about the gold. John was like a father to me, too. And I just can't move on until I've set things right.
All
right,
that was... No, this is the first time I saw it, actually. I've always wanted to see this, and I think I wanted to see it when I came out in theaters. But it was 2003. I was, 17?
Yeah, something
still
like that.
Still didn't have my driver's license, so... Couldn't make it to the movie theater.
Late bloomer. So what did you think about this one?
I like this one a lot more. Although I still agree, Italian Job Senior was fun to watch. They're both fun to watch, but I thought this one was better. It was a little more. The characters involved in the heist were a little more familiar with the audience. You know, you knew how kind of what the characters were. They did these short flashbacks with kind of how they got involved in crime or how they got involved with their speciality or whatever it was. And like you were saying, it isn't like a direct remake. It feels almost like a sequel or a reinterpretation of the original Italian Job. So as a double feature, the Italian Job double feature, it doesn't feel like you're watching the same movie again.
Yeah.
Or watching a remake of the same movie, you're basically watching two different movies with the same title.
Yeah, totally. I mean, this movie to me felt like it almost was a sequel. You know, it is a remake, but I think almost only in title and characters, really, and some of the stuff with the Mini Cooper and maybe like a little bit of stylization. But yeah, like the story is almost totally different. It's like in the original, the buildup is to the Italian job, and then that's what we see at the very end. That's what they're escaping from and all that kind of stuff. This one opens with the Italian job, and it's kind of, it flips the expectation a little bit. Like, the first 20 minutes of this film are the Italian job and this, you know, kind of ensuing escape and all that kind of stuff. And then it introduces this, you know, Edward Norton kind of Judas character of, like, yeah, basically just betraying all of his friends for the money and the greed and everything. And then this movie becomes more about revenge than a build up to any particular event, really. It's all about them getting back at Steve for killing John and all this kind of stuff. And, like, the group kind of coming together because they actually care about something. Where in the first one, it's just like these guys that you have no insight into their mental state or like what their motivations are or anything like that, really. This one, it's very clear that there's like an emotional core to this movie that all these people are kind of invested in because of that reason.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we're watching movies during this era of film, so we're kind of more familiar with the way that this movie was made. You know, mm-hmm. It had that character development. It kind of has that almost like, I don't know, when was the first Ocean's 11? It kind of felt like that kind of heist film for the 2000s.
And you see
the heist at the beginning, you see the heist at the end. There is a heist at the end, so it's kind of like it's an action-packed film as far as if you're digging kind of the thief finds the treasure storyline.
Yeah, totally. It's not, I didn't mean to imply that it was like a total reversal.
Yeah, it's not like a revenge movie like Taken or something.
Right, yeah.
But yeah, there are like multiple heists. But yeah, I do agree. Yeah, there's like an emotional, they're doing the heist for someone as opposed to just getting the treasure, although the treasure's nice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're doing it for the memory of Donald Sutherland's character.
Yeah, which it was kind of cool that his name was John Bridger as like a throwback to the Mr. Bridger from the other one.
Didn't pick up on that.
Yeah, and then I think this one is definitely much more of like an ensemble cast than the 69 version, because there's, like we were saying earlier, there's so few characters, and they do a really great job of introducing them, like you said, with these flashbacks and stuff. That's pretty early. I mean, the movie goes like this. Like, first 20 minutes is a job, then they cut to 1 year later, they introduce Stella, who's the daughter, and then she's kind of reintroduced to these, like, the main players. And, you know, that's like 30 minutes into the movie or something, which it seems kind of a long time, but it really doesn't feel that way. Like, we feel like we've known these characters for a while because we've seen kind of their rise to getting this gold, and then their pain of losing their leader and all this kind of, you know, their kind of father figure and stuff. And then they do a great job of introducing every one of these characters, so it's very clear who they are, what their background is, what their specialty is, and how they kind of fit into the whole thing. Where the original one lost me a little bit with some of these secondary people. Like, I had no idea what these people were supposed to be doing. You know, I knew that this one guy was devoted to, you know, changing out the computer program, and this one guy was going to be a backup driver, and that's about it. You know, like, they didn't really do a great job of that, in my opinion.
Plus they all wore blue jumpsuits, which didn't allow for any type of distinction among the characters.
Yeah, exactly.
It's hard for me to think of Most Deaf without a speech impediment, because I think the first movie, or one of the first movies I watched him in, was 16 Blocks with Bruce Willis,
mm-hmm.
where he kind of has a, not a lisp, but like a kind of a speech impediment.
Yeah.
So I expect him to have that in every other movie he's in. But he doesn't have it in this one.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the cast specifically. Was there anybody that kind of stood out to you as giving a better performance over anybody else, or any character in particular that you thought was better written than any others?
Ed Norton's character was surprisingly more douchey than I thought he could pull off. I'm not really a big fan of Norton, although I will watch movies he's in.
Mm-hmm.
So the way I feel about him doesn't really put me off watching him on film.
Yeah.
I like Statham. I like Seth Green. I like Mos Def. I like Mark Wahlberg, although his Boston accent wasn't as
pronounced
or prolific as I'd hoped it'd be. Although he did say something while he was playing basketball with Statham. He's like, get off the job. Or he says something in the Marky Mark voice, which kind of made me happy. And Charlize Theron, I like her.
Yeah.
You know, I like looking at her.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a good actress as well. So that didn't put me off. Yeah, like I said, this movie's a lot better. It's the better of the two because I think because we're more familiar with the actors and actresses that play the characters,
mm-hmm.
and also because we get a better look at the characters, and yeah, it's a little more closer knit. You know, there aren't mm-hmm. as many characters to kind of keep track of like you saw with Italian Job Senior.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to like provide the wrong impression that I think this is a great movie because I don't. I just really like it because it's a lot of fun. I think
it's not, yeah, it's not a great movie. I mean, great movies are the title of great movies reserved for like sweeping epics or things that define movies.
Yeah,
but yeah, I mean, it's a good movie. Some people would call it great because it's just a fun time at the movies.
Yeah, I mean, if that's your definition of great, then sure. But yeah. I just mean, like, there's a lot of stuff. It's kind of difficult for me to separate myself from my initial impressions of this movie because I've been so familiar with it for so long. And, you know, when I first saw it back in 2003, I wasn't really critically thinking about movies and stuff. So it's just, it's got a lot of nostalgia for me.
Late bloomer.
So I think, you know, if you take away some of the fun of it and look at like what actually happens, a lot of it is very cliche, you know, with like the, you know, the lines that come up at the end where, of course, Edward Norton's character has switched out the safe and it's not the Worthington 1000 and she has to
right.
do it by touch just like her dad did, even though like
right.
it was already alluded to earlier in the movie that she has no idea how to do that because she doesn't operate that way. She needs the technology to do it. And of course, she manages to pull it off. So, you know, there's like some kind of... Yeah, I mean, clearly there's spoiler alerts all over the place, flying left and right out here. But, you know, there's like some of these things that come into the picture, and like you basically know how the movie's going to end right when it starts and stuff like that. You know,
see, I didn't because I had seen the previous one before this one, so I was like, oh, they're going to leave me.
I guess that's
going to leave me. They're going to leave me hanging again.
I guess that's true. Yeah,
it was nice to see a movie that actually, spoiler alert, actually has a conclusion.
You can stop saying spoiler.
I don't want to ruin identity for anybody. So
right, yeah.
I have to say it now whenever I talk about film.
We've come close to ruining identity for listeners of this podcast many times. So far, actually, that I've had to edit us out of a couple episodes, ruining the ending unintentionally. But what were some of your favorite scenes in this movie, Tyler? Do you have any?
I like the part where Seth Green kind of yells really loud in the
There are two parts.
Yeah, in the airport carousel that he's kind of sitting at for some inexplicable reason.
Yeah.
There's the one where everybody starts coming into that carousel
mm-hmm.
while he's working on his laptop.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was pretty humorous. And then when they realize how much money in gold they have,
mm-hmm.
He kind of yells really loud and everybody's kind of look at him and he's like, oh, it's just the Holy Spirit. You guys should try it out. So
yeah.
That part was pretty funny. I like the part where Statham and Mos Def are hanging out in the Mini Coupe, and he's like, $27 million. He's like, say it again. He's like, $27 million. That part was pretty funny. And, yeah, like, all the characters were really fun to watch. Ed Norton, he was just kind of like, he was like the douche, man.
Yeah, you love to hate him.
Hitting on the cable, worker. I mean, she's there to do a job. I mean, wait till she's off the clock to start throwing your machismo at her. It was just disgusting. He's like begging on his knees, figuratively.
Yeah.
You don't even have to give me your phone number. Just meet me somewhere. Seriously. God, I need to go to dinner with a woman.
Yeah.
This mustache is not selling it.
Yeah, and he, like, of course he takes all of their ideas, you know, and it's just like...
Oh, yeah.
He's such a well-written bad guy that you really love to hate him, and you're like, you feel for the other characters when they see that he's just, you know, has no creativity, no imagination. That's what they keep, you know, repeating over and over again throughout the film.
And then when at the very beginning, when they kind of for some reason drive the van off the bridge into the frozen water, pretty sure you can get hypothermia from just kind of going into below zero water.
Yeah, but they had AK-47s. They were just going to get shot if they didn't. That was their only chance, really.
Oh, no, I understand that. But then they're walking around in their clothes afterward. I don't know how they survived coming out of the mountains.
Right.
No car. They had to trek back to sea level. Yeah. And when you're supposed to take the clothes off because the clothes actually keep you cold.
Right.
So you're either going to get pneumonia, hypothermia, or death.
See, this is one of those things that I was talking about where if you take a look at the actual movie and like break down the plot events, it doesn't really make a lot of sense.
Where do they bury Donald Sutherland?
I think they just left him on the shore.
Just float him down the water like Lord of the Rings style. Put him in a boat filled with the guns used against him.
Some of my favorite...
Spoiler alert, if you haven't seen Fellowship of the Ring.
Good lord.
Sorry.
I really liked Seth Green's handsome Rob impression when Statham is hitting on, or is like going to retrieve the cable girl's shirt and van or whatever, and Seth Green's interpretation of what he's saying and stuff. I thought that was really awesome. And then
the guy that steals his idea for Napster.
Yeah.
Now, wasn't the creator of Napster in the Facebook, in the social network?
Yeah, he was. Yeah, Sean Parker, yeah.
Did they refer to him as Sean Parker?
I think so. I wasn't sure if I misheard this. I think they called him Sean Fanning, and I'll have to check.
It was just kind of funny how they did that. They're like, he called it Napster because I was taking a nap when he stole my idea.
You know what? I'm looking this up right now, and apparently Sean Fanning is the guy who developed Napster. I'm wondering who Sean Parker.
All lies.
Huh. Wait. Okay. I'm reading this from Wikipedia. Let me quote this to you real quick. Because their first names are pronounced the same and because of the repeated mentions of Napster, many people will assume that Sean Fanning is the character played by Justin Timberlake in the movie The Social Network. That is not the case. Timberlake plays a real-life person named Sean Parker, who is also heavily involved in Napster along with Fanning. Sean Fanning had no direct connection to Facebook. Interesting. Okay. So.
Another mystery solved.
Yes, there we go.
Thanks. The Not Just New Movies podcast.
Yeah, I actually legitimately am glad that I know that now, just in case that comes up.
Tell it to other people that try to misinform you.
Right.
Justin Timberlake invented Napster.
There were two NBC Thursday night comic characters. Did you notice that?
Yep, there was Oscar from The Office as the security detail.
Yep.
And then the actor who's in the car reading the script during the green light is the bald guy from 30 Rock.
Yep. You know,
what is his name? It starts with an L.
I don't know. I only...
He works with Tina Fey or Liz Lemon's character in 30 Rock. Yeah. I was wondering if you'd pick that out because I know you just started watching 30 Rock, so I didn't know if you knew who that guy was.
Yeah, I don't know his name. I don't know the character's name in that show, but I definitely picked that up. I was kind of hoping you would know his name, but...
Starts with an L.
Okay, all right. That's all we need.
Larity, maybe? Larity?
There was that character of Yevon kind of struck me as really strange. Do you know what I'm talking about? The guy that Edward Norton...
Ukrainian mobster? Oh.
Yeah, like the pawn shop owner guy or whatever.
Pawn shop owner, okay.
He would just like spout off on all these political things, like uninvited. You know, nobody, like, especially with... Edward Norton's character going in there and like wanting to do this kind of shady deal or whatever. Like the guy just kept on saying like, "Oh, invest in gold because the government's not gonna stick up for you." Blah blah blah. Like, you know, just kind of like pontificating about all these different things. And like Edward Norton couldn't give a crap. Like he doesn't care about that. And like the guy just keeps talking and talking. And it felt like a really strange way for the screenwriters to like slip in some sort of political ideologies or something. It struck me as really strange. Later on, he says like, you know, oh, you guys celebrate your heroes and stuff, like Columbus, who's just looking for gold and, like, slave trade. And then, like, that's how he realizes, like, the gold came from Italy, and it was, like, the gold from the Italian job, basically.
Yeah.
And it just seemed to me like that was such a stretch of like, you know, he starts at this one thing and just kind of through his random stream of consciousness thought arrives at this conclusion. It's like, it's like, to me, I can see the writers sitting in a room going like, how are we going to have this guy know that it was from the Italian job? Let's just have him be like a really talkative character that just says random things. You know, it just seemed kind of like lazy.
A verbal thought process.
Yeah.
He kind of makes, he's like, you have a day for Columbus. Just took a wrong turn somewhere and wiped out an indigenous population.
So
Columbus, I love you, man.
Sail on. When I was watching the first, the Italian Job Senior, as you've taken to calling it, I thought that that movie would be much more about the cars than this one. And after watching both of them so close to each other, I actually don't think that's the case. I think both of them kind of highlight the cars equally. Because, like, you know, the job at the very end, the revenge job, if you will, of the 2003 version, it, like, really heavily relies on these Mini Coopers. Like, that's a good chunk of the movie where they're, like, driving through Hollywood and doing all this stuff. So, I mean, what did you think of the like the depiction of the cars and stuff, or just the end action in general of this film?
Of the 2003 version?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't really... Like, the Mini Coupe, I think, in this film was just kind of an homage to the original film, because obviously they could have all had Ferraris or, you know, some type of fast car that we've come up with since 1969.
Right.
But again, they wanted to show kind of like the speed and obviously, you know, kind like, of the quickness and the kind of the stunt work that a coupe could go through.
Yeah.
Just kind of carry the film, because obviously 1969, the vehicle stunts they were doing then were probably pretty good. But, you know, 30 years later, you know, 34 years later.
Right.
You know, you're going to have to live up to kind of a higher standard as far as what you're seeing cars do, you know, jumping in front of a subway train with, you know, and kind of barely nicking the bumper of the train to get into the tunnel. And just kind of stuff like that, especially when, and I like, and this is kind of a side note, I like the idea and the science behind the effect of the gold itself in the heist, in kind of, how they figure out what they can do.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm sure you'll remember the way kind of Seth Green figures out which truck it's on is how low, you know, the tire or the distance between something, the truck with the gold in it is lower because gold is such a heavy material. And so they, like, for the Mini Coupes to carry the gold, they have to add all these extensions and.
Yeah, and, like, during the prep, you know, they're driving around with weights in the trunk and stuff, like, trying to you know, predict how heavy it's going to be and how the car will be able to handle it and all that stuff.
Yeah, so I like that. But, yeah, I mean, I think that might be why we see better car action in this one than we do in the other one, is because kind of a change in decades, change in generation, what we've seen in car chase. I mean, like, the French Connection wasn't that the 70s.
I think so, yeah.
You know, when we see Mad Max with kind of, I guess that kind of is like car chases.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Although there's maybe 1, 2, 3 cars in the post-apocalyptic Australia. And, you know, we've seen a lot since 1969, so they have to kind of boost up what we see
in
the 2003 version.
Yeah. I think, you know, you said homage, like that's a good word, especially even during the end action sequence, the big chase and stuff through Hollywood, they go down into the sewers and stuff. And there's that scene that's pretty much taken, like lifted from the 69 version where they're driving through like the circular sewer, thing and like going, you know, weaving up and down the sides and stuff. And like the guys on the motorcycles are following them and everything. So yeah, I really enjoyed, like, you know, you said in the very beginning, the pacing of this, Well, I think you were actually talking about the other one where the pacing was good, but the pacing in this one was great. Like, you know, it's very clearly like a modern action movie, you know, where it's like, it's almost formulaic where like, okay, this, you know, you've hit like 30 minute point and nothing's happened. We need an action scene. You know, we need these beats going through all the time. We need to see like something. We need the score to kick up here to really kind of drive it home. And we need to see the test of Seth Green breaking into the like the LA traffic control center and stuff, and being able to do the test run of like having car crashes and stuff like that. Just things to keep us entertained throughout the movie. I thought they really did a really great job of that. With the helicopter standoff, what were your thoughts on that near the end?
It reminded me of Live Free or Die Hard or Sudden Death.
Yep.
Both involving helicopters.
Yep.
I love helicopters versus man.
Don't you think that's just kind of a ludicrous thing to do if you're Edward Norton?
No. Well, yes, but that's why I enjoy it, is because it's ludicrous. He fit under this like overpass with his helicopter, and he's like playing chicken with a car in his helicopter. And he goes for the tail to kind of block off the car. You know, if I was a helicopter pilot, that probably wouldn't be the first thing I think of. I would go, I'm going to go body into the car. I'm not going to use the tail.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe like turn the main propellers into the car, but that would obviously result in some type of an explosion.
Yeah.
But, it's ludicrous. You say it's ludicrous, and it is, but that's why I enjoy it.
Yeah. I don't really know like how effective that method is of like intimidating Mark Wahlberg as you're just like, yeah, like you said, playing chicken back and forth. It's like, what is his end game there? Like, what is he really, what do you think that's going to accomplish? But especially as like the other people are getting away with the gold, you know, he's not really thinking that one through very much. But
I will say the ending of this movie kind of reminded me of, spoiler alert, The Departed.
Okay, let's give an even more clear
spoiler. An even bigger spoiler alert for those who haven't seen The Departed. Great movie. Kind of, we're going to spoil the ending, I think. I'm not going to spoil the entire ending, but it involves Mark Wahlberg.
go ahead, let's hear it. What is this?
Like at the end of The Italian Job, Ed Norton tries to get onto the train with the gold, and he opens the door, and Mark Wahlberg standing there.
Ah.
In The Departed, DiCaprio's character. Was it DiCaprio?
It was Matt Damon, I think, at the very end.
Yes, Matt Damon, and he opens the door, or an elevator opens or something, and Mark Wahlberg's there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, okay. So you're just speaking like strictly visually then with a door opening.
I'm talking Mark Wahlberg in a surprise appearance, the character. Okay. Yes, these two movies have similarities.
Okay.
Other than that, I couldn't say.
All right.
But just for that quick moment where Mark Wahlberg steps onto screen, very similar, very similar.
Right, nice.
What if Scorsese and F. Gary Gary had a conversation about?
Oh, Lord, I bet he called them, and yeah, they had a big meeting about that. So I really liked the look of both of these movies. In the opening credits of both of them, I wrote down the directors of photography because they're both really, really famous. I don't know if you noticed this, but in the first one, the guy's name is Douglas Slocum, and he was responsible for the he was the director of photography for the original Rollerball movie, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Temple of Doom, and Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, as well as Never Say Never Again. So, I mean, this guy has, like, done some freaking classic stuff in his day.
Say Never Again.
And then in this, the Italian Job 2003 version, the F. Gary Gary version, Wally Pfister is the director of photography, and this is Christopher Nolan's kind of cohort, who has worked with him on Memento and Insomnia and all the Batman films, as well as The Prestige and Inception. So,
does Pfister have a good relationship with
With
Christian Eric, Bale?
Oh, with Christian Bale. Oh, I see. Are you alluding to the infamous Christian Bale?
That wasn't the same guy, obviously.
No, it was a different
guy. I think
guy.
His name was Bruce, the director of photography during Terminator.
Yeah, for Terminator
Salvation. No! No!
Oh, man. That.
That's interesting. That's interesting that you mentioned that. That's kind of cool.
Yeah, because, I mean, I really like both of these guys as far as, like, the films that they've done and the looks that they establish and stuff. And I think the Italian Job 03 version probably more than the 69 version just looks a little bit more, I don't know, almost...
Sleeker?
Yeah, sleeker, but almost at the same time, like... conventional, whereas I think the one in 69 probably with like the cameras mounted to the side of the cars as they're going through the hills and stuff, and like a lot of the chase sequences and things, I mean, I can't verify this with fact, but I feel like a lot of that stuff was you know, relatively new to film, you know, like being able to capture the chase in the way that they did in the 69 version. And this one, like, they didn't really do anything inventive camera wise but it all just looked good, you know. It just looks like a quality movie. So
did Slocum do any Bond movies?
Never Say Never Again was the only one, and isn't that correct me if
not
I'm
not a Bond movie.
Yeah, that's the only one that lies outside of the Bond canon, right?
In my opinion, yes.
Well, I don't think
ask just... another if you had, well, okay, the MGM kind of got the rights to some of the literary characters,
uh-huh.
And the did I say MGM? I meant Fox.
Okay.
Fox got some of the rights to some of the literary characters, and I've actually written an article about this on the Solar Sentinel, so check out the archives. I think it was 2009.
Okay, I'll put it in the show notes.
And what was happening is that they could make a remake of the book. And they kind of did Thunderball, so that's mm-hmm. Never Say Never Again. And they could use the character name. They could use different characters like, what's his name in Thunderball? The guy with the eye patch starts with an L. And, you know, Kim Basinger's in it. Sean Connery's in it, obviously. But it isn't in the, you know, the kind of the general generational movies that we see with the James Bond franchise. The Broccoli produced films from Dr. No all the way to Quantum of Solace.
Mm-hmm.
So it is kind of outside of the family of James Bond films, but it is a James Bond movie because it has the character in it. But there are other movies like that too, where they use the James Bond character, but it isn't an official Broccoli produced.
Really?
Yeah, there's, I think, Casino Royale. I think Woody Allen's in it.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And, kind of from the 70s, I think.
Right, yeah.
So, yeah, they've done that before.
Okay, all right.
It's nice. Kind of weird watching it, though, because you think... Because it is... I don't know. That's another podcast on itself. I don't want to give my thoughts on that movie.
Yeah, fair enough.
Because it's weird watching it when you've seen all the rest of them.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we should do a James Bond movie for the podcast. Have you ever seen Under Majesty's Secret Service?
I have not seen that one.
I think you would. I think if you liked the Italian Job, the 69 version, Under Majesty's Secret Service is somewhat similar.
Okay. All right. Well, maybe the Apple II will give us something. We'll see what happens. All right. So let's go. Just kind of concluding thoughts on both of them. What did you think, or anything that you wanted to say, just as by way of wrap up?
Yeah. If you like heist movies, if you like car chases, you know, I'm not going to recommend one over the other. You know, obviously, I'm going to say the 2003 version I thought was a little better, but both, they're entirely different movies. They're, you know, you can watch one night and watch the other the next night and still feel like you've watched two different movies.
Mm-hmm.
So they're both fun to watch. They're both paced well. There's, you know, there's nothing really wrong with either one of them. So check them out.
Very well said. Yeah, I totally agree. I liked the 03 one.
That's number three, Ben.
Man, yeah, I'm giving you too much credit these days. I liked the 03 one. Also, I wanted to mention that John Powell did the score for the 2003 one, and there were some kind of inspirations, I think, some cues taken from Quincy Jones' original score. That was one other thing that I had written down that we didn't mention. But I really like
Quincy Jones also appears in the Austin Powers movies.
Right, there we go. There's yet another connection. But yeah, I really liked the score of this movie too. I thought it had this kind of pulsing quality too that kind of really aided in keeping that pacing up and making us interested in what was going on all the time. So the comedy is a lot more pronounced in the 2003 version. I think that's because of the smaller cast and like the way that we have come to understand their relationship, and a lot of the history between those characters is like implied as opposed to shown. You see them kind of messing with each other and stuff like that, and it just kind of – it makes you feel more of a part of the group than the 69 one did, where you feel a little bit more excluded. So if I were to recommend one over the other, I would just say watch the 2003 one if you haven't seen it. But if you haven't seen it, then why are you listening to this? Because we gave you like 40 spoiler alerts. So all right, so let's go ahead and rev up the Apple II and see what we're going to be watching next week.
Yeah, let's do it. All right, Ben, we're actually going to be watching a baseball-themed movie, Spring Training, the beginning of baseball season. We're going to be watching Eight Men Out, according to the Apple II, starring John Cusack, the winning Charlie Sheen, and it's talking about the Chicago White Sox back in the 19-teens, so we should have a good old period piece on our hands.
All right, sounds like a plan. So
lots of fedoras.
I believe that movie is... Yes, it's on Netflix Watch Instant, so feel free to check that out. You guys can watch that and email us your thoughts at notjustnewmovies@gmail.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. Let us know what you think of that movie or any other that we've reviewed. Call us at 904-469-6566, and we will play your voicemail on the air.
We will absolutely play your voicemail on the air. What its content is.
Right. So you guys can subscribe for free to this podcast in iTunes. You can leave us a review. That would be awesome. You can check us out on Facebook. And we are on Twitter at twitter.com/NJNMpodcast. We do have, looks like, three new followers here, at Shooter Bays, at VGO Podcast, which is the Video Game Outsiders podcast that Michelle Madison, our guest last week, co-hosts.
An excellent podcast. Check it out.
Yes, definitely.
Also, their Warcraft Outsiders podcast is pretty humorous, too.
Cool. And the final new follower of this week is at Jared_Blanchard, our old friend who joined us in the Batman episode back in episode one of this podcast. So.
And the Signs episode as well, I believe.
Yes, indeed.
Along with Timmy T.
Yes, right on. Cool. So, Tyler, you want to go ahead and finish up the character name game before we wrap this whole thing up?
I can, or we can play another Up My Cue.
I don't think that I could deal with the rejection of losing more than – I think I've like reached my limit. So it's probably going to be bad enough me guessing this character name game and probably losing out on that a lot, but we'll see what happens.
Okay. All right. The character name game for this week is Amanda Grayson.
Amanda Grayson.
Yes, I believe fan-made trailers are up for grabs.
Wait, what?
No, I'm just kidding. Trying to steer you in the wrong direction.
Oh, man, that did it all right.
If you've ever seen the Grayson trailer, YouTube it right away. It's awesome.
Yes, it is. All right, so...
Amanda Grayson.
All right, so this character has been played by Winona Ryder. Winona Ryder movies. Let's see. Mr. Deeds.
Incorrect.
Black Swan.
Was she in that?
Yeah.
That's wrong.
Wow.
If you couldn't tell from my exclamation.
Beetlejuice.
Ooh, no. Don't say it three times.
Let's see. How about freaking A? What relation could this possibly have to a movie that came out last week? I don't know. Give me a hint. I'm dying here.
What kind of hint do you want?
Maybe a genre or something, or like the I don't know. Director might give it away.
Yeah, well.
Okay, genre, I guess?
Science fiction?
Winona Ryder in a science fiction movie? What?
Think back.
Or like Alien 3 or something? Was she in that?
Ooh, that would fit the genre, but no, that's incorrect.
Yeah, I can't think of a Winona Ryder science fiction movie. I'm dying.
Would you like to know a year, perhaps?
Sure, yeah.
2009.
What? No. Was this a movie that was released straight to DVD?
No.
Okay, all right. Winona Ryder.
Come on, take me seriously.
Science fiction.
Don't look it up.
I'm not looking it up. I'm not.
I remember one time you tried typing it in.
No.
You're like, oh yeah, 2009. Click, 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 click. Oh wait, I'm catching myself. I'm looking.
Oh yeah, yeah. No. Well, I did that and then stopped.
Yeah, I know. I
didn't actually complete the transaction. Let me think here. Dude, I need another. Like, who else is in it? Give me another actor that's in this movie.
Who else is in it? At random?
Yeah, it's just another person. Any other person.
Rachel Nichols. Chris Hemsworth. Jennifer Moore.
Oh, okay. Oh, man.
Anton Yelchin.
I totally forgot she was in that. Okay, the answer is
John Cho.
Star
Trek. Yes, it is. It is Star Trek. Winona Ryder plays Amanda Grayson, who is Spock's mother.
Her
human
name's
mother.
Amanda Grayson in that movie? That's such a weird... Like, she plays... Like, she married a Vulcan. She's like a human who... Oh, man. I don't know if they ever actually say her name in that movie. That's
it's on
why.
IMDb. It's official.
Okay. All right. I'll give you that.
Amanda Grayson was played by Winona Ryder, who also... Star Trek also stars Simon Pegg as Scotty. And Simon Pegg was in Paul. This week.
Of course. All right. Nicely.
Boom. Winning.
Man. I can't wait until you're...
Sarek.
What?
Ben Cross was also in, and he played Sarek, Amanda Grayson's husband.
Yeah. I can't wait until you're done with your boom winning phase, by the way. All right. Let's go back and forth and just tell people where they can find more of our work on the internet this week. Tyler, let's start with you.
Okay. You'll always find me at the Solar Sentinel, which we've changed our content now. It's not just Traherne centered. It's everything. We're kind of back to our original business as usual, except the look of the blog may stay the same, but the content has changed. This week I came out with a Irish mythology themed article.
Man, that thing was in depth, I will tell you that.
It's intense, isn't it? Yeah, I had to go back and read the Irish mythology book and kind of, you know, I wanted to give the most information without overwhelming the reader, but I guess I didn't achieve that. So you can find me there. You can find me at notjustnewmovies.com, reviewing movies through March and hopefully reviewing some more movies after March.
Mm-hmm.
And you can find me at Destageddon, where we just put up a new Detonation, Traherne, Panther Joe, Triple H main event.
Nice. So, and that is at destageddon.blogspot.com?
Yeah, it is. It is. We also have a Irish-themed Detonation, that same one, with a tag team between Goldberg and Ugga the Bulldog, with Soldier Britain teamed up with Lobster Dog. So.
Oh.
No animal cruelty occurs in Detonation. We make a point to say that.
So if you guys are looking for your fictional wrestling fix, that is the place to go. You guys can track me down at twitter.com/BenPears. You can find me writing occasionally at geektyrant.com. I actually wrote up a kind of a piece that I want to promote really quickly. You mentioned Paul came out, which is a really good movie. I think a lot of people should see, especially if you like Simon Pegg and Nick Frost and, you know, Hot Fuzz and Shaun of the Dead and all those kinds of movies. But there's a bunch of pop culture references in this movie, and I wrote a piece at Geek Tyrant that kind of compiles all of them. If you just go
them.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to. I'm enlisting the help of the commenters to fill in whatever gaps I may have missed. But
All right. I think you're confident enough to say every single pop culture reference in the film.
Right, yeah, I think that's actually what it's called. So you can go to Geek Tyrant and just do a search on the bar on the right side and just type in, like, pop culture Paul, and I'm sure you'll find it there.
We could link it to the article here.
Yeah, I'll do that too, but in case people are listening in their cars or something like that. Yeah. I can also be found writing for Filmonic.com, not just newmovies.com, very, very rarely at moviecultists.com. And
haven't read a thing on that site yet.
You guys can also hear me on the Geek Tyrant Weekly podcast. So music for this show is provided by George Turner and the Bandits. You can find their music at gtbandits.com. They are also on Twitter and Facebook, so check them out there. And again, we're going to be watching 8 Men Out, the John Cusack, Charlie Sheen film, and that is on Netflix Instant. Feel free to check it out. Send us an email. Leave us a voicemail with your thoughts. And thanks for listening, guys. We'll see you next week.
Later.
Money that